We welcome here to The Shilling Show David Murata, the president of Murata Wealth Management, on what I think is a really timely discussion. We're revisiting the 2008 crash of the markets and then what happened afterwards. And what is normal market volatility? Because I think people lose sight of that. David Murata is online at muratahonmoney.com. And David, it's really interesting. I think it was within the last 6 months, maybe the last 4 months, that I said to you, gosh, the markets have been really quiet lately. You know, it's almost like we haven't seen any of this wild ride that we were used to seeing a couple years ago. And we talked about that a little bit on the air. Well, that wild ride, Mr. Toad's wild ride, has revisited us here. And so I guess we need to look at the recent market volatility and what the underlying causes are. I'm sorry, there we go.
Yeah, we had a period in which, you know, for 1 year the markets did nothing but go up. The S&P 500 was up every single month. That was a new record that had never happened before. You know, and that kind of lack of volatility was actually unprecedented and out of the ordinary. If there was one thing I wish that investors understood better, is it's the statement that the markets are inherently volatile. And what that means in terms of what returns you can expect to see and what the volatility looks like. And I've been working on just statistics in the stock market because I think that helps sort of understand where we are and where we go. And a typical, you know, a daily stock market movement averages about 0.65%. Mm-hmm. That's just normal. You know, during low volatility, that goes down as low as 0.32 for the year that was just going up. For large volatility, you know, the standard deviation on just that 0.65 is 0.71. So anything plus or minus, you know, between 0 and 1.36 is actually considered very, very normal. And if you called your financial advisor every single time the market was down or up more than 1.36, you'd call them about every 9 trading days. So you just be constantly calling your financial advisor. And I use as a threshold, you really shouldn't be calling your financial advisor for market movements, even once a year. Can you imagine, as a financial advisor, if every single one of your clients calls you on the worst day of the year? And if you called your financial advisor every single time the markets were down more than 3.43%, you'd be calling them on average every single year. And then what do you want your financial advisor to do? You don't want him to sell everything because you've experienced the volatility of the markets. Now, are you going to stay around for the return of the markets or not? And selling on down days is actually the worst thing to do. If you're going to sell something on a down day, you should be selling bonds and buying back into stocks as you rebalance your portfolio. So market volatility is just normally, you know, ever up and down as much as 3.43%. Now, in 2008, we actually had multiple days that were up or down, you know, 3.43%. And that was just the volatility that we were having at that time. And even understanding why we were having that volatility, I think, helps. And that is, every single financial institution was trying to raise capital, so they were selling off their entire portfolio.
I think I want to spend just a moment here on the role of a financial advisor. You are not a counselor. I mean, you're a counselor of sorts, but you're not like a counselor where you'd go into the office and sit down and get counseled. So I think a lot of this is it's hand-holding in a way. And I guess it just really depends on the financial advisor if they want to be seen that way, if that's how they perceive themselves. Because otherwise, people would be educated perhaps on the intake from people like you as to, hey, here's what to expect if you're investing money in the stock market.
Yeah, I've actually heard it said that one of the greatest benefits of having a financial advisor is the counseling role when the markets are down. And people have put that value of a financial advisor as high as 3% annually.
Okay.
And the reason is because if you just buy and hold and you count that as like zero, buying and rebalancing, meaning that you're going to sell what's up and buy what's down, the Yale Foundation found their study suggested that the rebalancing bonus was about 1.6% every year. On the other hand, Morningstar did a study and found that mutual fund investors underperformed the very mutual funds they were invested in because they moved money into the mutual fund after it had gone up, and they moved money out of the mutual fund after it had gone down. And so the difference between a positive buy and rebalance 1.6% and a negative 1.4% is actually about 3%. And they call that the behavior gap between what you should do and what most people do, because we know both of those facts. So yes, there is a great amount of counseling that goes on, and your financial advisor keeps you from making the big mistakes that our brains are sort of wired to for us to make. And so we do take that on. But as you suggested, we try to take that on at the beginning of the relationship. When I first meet with a prospective client, we go over the fact of what we're going to do when the markets are down, or even a particular category is down. If it's down, we're going to probably buy back into it. And if it's a category is up, we're probably going to sell some and rebalance. And then as we're setting our asset allocation, we go through what I call a market downturn dress rehearsal. And what we do is we say, okay, so now let's just imagine the markets are down, we'll pick a number, 30%,
mm-hmm.
And you feel terrible about that. What are we going to do? We're going to sell some of those bonds you're so glad you have. We're going to rebalance and buy back into those stocks that you're so sorry that you have. Because that rebalancing actually will help the markets, help your portfolio come back quicker.
David Morata is our guest, MoratonMoney.com. We're talking about revisiting 2008 and also what is normal market volatility and how should you respond to the sorts of things that we're seeing here, at least recently on a daily basis. If you have comments or questions or even challenges for our guest, David Morata, it is 434-977-1070. We'd love to hear from you at 977-1070. We'll come back on the other side. We're going to talk about what happened in 2008. How does that compare to what's going on right now? And could we be in for that sort of a bumpy ride once again here about 10 years later? Stay with The Shilling Show. We resume in a moment. Hey, The Shilling Show rolls on. It's a Tuesday edition of the program. David Morata with us, MorataOnMoney.com. Revisiting the 2008 market crash and the normal market volatility, what we can expect, what is normal, and over what period of time. I think that's another important thing. Let's go back. Let's take a trip down memory lane to talk about 2008, David. Let's talk about what happened then and why it happened.
Yeah, during 2008, you know, I'd written an article in March of 2008 talking about the toxic assets that were subprime mortgages and stuff like that. And it was pretty obvious to a lot of people that this was, you know, sort of caused by giving mortgages to people who didn't deserve it. Normally, mortgages are very, very secure loans because they're backed by a very major asset. And people who buy houses are generally among the most financially secure people anyway. So. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of double. But the Community Reinvestment Act had caused, actually forced banks to make loans into neighborhoods and people who didn't weren't able to qualify otherwise for loans. And that had really made unstable the entire subprime market. And in 2008, it was beginning to become obvious. What wasn't obvious is that a lot of the banks were using these packages of subprime mortgages as collateral when they were loaning money to each other. Mm. And our entire financial system is dependent upon being able to say, hey, I need some money, need some cash. So I'm a bank and I borrow some from you. And what do I put up for collateral? I put up something that's really secure like mortgages. So in the end of 2008, banks began to realize these subprime assets were not viable and that some of the banks might actually be insolvent and be unable to repay their loans. But it was unclear how to determine because all of the rating agencies had basically rated these really well. And so no one had yet gone in to say, this one's not good, this one's good. But it became obvious that some were not going to be good. And what that meant was that banks wouldn't loan money to each other. And so the velocity of money froze and money stopped moving around. And the money supply looks like both the amount of money out there times the velocity of money out there. And so suddenly the velocity of money goes to zero and there's no money out there. And so the banks needed to raise cash. Now the only way they could raise cash was by selling off all of their other financial assets. And banks that couldn't raise enough cash at that moment went bankrupt. And so it was a matter of survival. It's kind of like if your neighbor got into credit card debt and put his entire contents of his house out on his front lawn in a yard sale. And you look out and you say, hey, that couch is the same couch I have. It didn't sell for 15. It finally sold for 10. Maybe I should put my couch out before it's going for 5.
Mm.
No, that's a terrible idea because you're not in credit card debt. You should go buy his grandmother's antique dining room table, store it in your basement for 6 months, and then sell it for twice its value. But when you look down the road, everybody was selling everything. And the way markets move is that when there are more sellers than buyers, the market makers have to buy it. But they get to move the price down.
Mm.
And you should also understand that the percentage of stock that sells every single day is about 0.38%. So all the market movement every single day is based on maybe a third of a percent of the shares that are being bought and sold. And so a very small amount of volume can move the markets precipitously if all the sellers are sellers and the only one buying is the market makers. The market will just drop like a rock, but at some point it finds resistance, because as the price of stocks drop, you and I could pull our pocket change out as they approach zero and buy every stock in America. So they can't go to zero. At some point they find resistance, and long before you and I can buy it for pocket change, Warren Buffett buys it for his pocket change, which is much bigger than our pocket change. So when the markets were dropping like that, they were dropping simply because there were a ton of sellers of huge financial organizations selling their entire portfolio, trying not to go bankrupt. And so when the selling was done in March of 2009, then the markets began to rebound. And after the bottom, we had the three highest weeks on the Dow of going up that we have ever had in history, probably never to be had again. And then the market continued up for another, you know, 5.5 months after that, for a 6-month up period. And the down movement on the market from October 1st through March was probably a 3 or 4 sigma event, meaning it was 3 or 4 standard deviations. And the up was also a 3 or 4 sigma event as the markets came back up again. That's not unheard of in the markets to have that kind of volatility. The markets, if you think of a normal distribution, the stock market is not a normal distribution. It's a normal distribution with lumpy tails, meaning fast up movements and fast down movements, faster than would normally be in a normal Gaussian distribution. There's a whole math behind that. The Gaussian is 1.0 of this power laws, and stock market is actually 1.5, meaning it has these lumpy tails. So it's a little bit more on the edges. At any rate, all of that down and up movement was really caused by, at least in my opinion, it was caused by the government having destabilized mortgages back in the mid-1990s. And sometimes government programs like that take a decade before they burst. Sometimes they take 2 decades. There were some economists who wrote back then, you know, this could destabilize the – I went back and looked at all the papers – and someone said, you know, this, it probably won't, but it could destabilize what mortgages are and make them less secure. And he was, you know, completely right. And you never know with a government program whether the worst fears you have will come true or not. Mm-hmm. And when they come true, it's so many decades later that you can't hold the politicians accountable. So, so it's just better when politicians don't try to destabilize what are fluid financial markets, because they're holding one point in a complex equation constant when it needs to move around to keep all of the other points stable. And when they hold that point constant, everything else blows up, and then they say, oh, those other things are blowing up. Maybe we should try holding them constant too. And it doesn't work. It's a fluid, you know, cause and effect. It's a fluid supply and demand. And you can't hold one constant and expect the other one to remain in its place.
You know, David, I want to go back to something that you talked about, because I think there's a critically important lesson here, and it was the Community Reinvestment Act. And so the government got involved in trying to manipulate the markets and the way that business evaluated the risk in certain neighborhoods and say, well, just ignore those guidelines. Is it your contention that if that had not happened, had it not been for the Community Reinvestment Act, that this 2008 meltdown would have not have happened as it did? Or was that just a small part of it?
No, I think that was the major part of it. If you watch The Big Short, it's not a bad movie. Sometimes financial movies don't portray the truth very well. Mm-hmm. The truth is contained in The Big Short if you're willing to look for it. The people are going around trying to figure out if these mortgage-backed, complex investments actually have any value. And they go up to one door and they say, I'd like to talk to Buster, you know, who is you know, the co-signer on this loan. And the guy says, yeah, Buster's my dog. and that's when they realize, you know, sort of there's nothing behind this but promises, you know, empty promises, and people could put down anything they wanted to and they didn't have to have income and stuff like that. I found it. This is the economics professor, Stan Liebowitz and Ted Day wrote in 1998. in their economic inquiry article. After the warm and fuzzy glow of flexible underwriting standards has worn off, we may discover that there is nothing more than standards that led to bad loans. These policies will have done a disservice to their punitive beneficiaries if they are dispossessed from their homes. This is 1998, right? Mm-hmm. after the couple of years after the Community Reinvestment Act. These economists are saying, hey, you know, this may result in just a lot of foreclosures, and it may not be a really great deal. And it may completely have destabilized the financial markets this way. They were, if you go back and you read my article from March of that year, everything I say is correct. I just didn't realize the disastrous consequences it would have as all of these things went belly up and they sold all of their assets off from the market. In retrospect, it's always very clear. Going forward, it's just a possibility and it's one among many. Which is why there's lots of things that the government does that doesn't blow up, but could easily have blown up with a different roll of the dice.
And I would say also that I understand, and maybe you've heard about this, that we're almost back to where it was then. We're making a lot of risky loans with very, very low down payments. And I'm looking at this saying, if this is true, and you can tell me if it's not, but why have we not learned that lesson that, that's not a good way to go forward? That's a very risky approach.
Yeah, the Community Reinvestment Act had it as its stated goal to increase home ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Home ownership is now less than it was before the Community Reinvestment Act, partly because now the underwriting process is more onerous rather than less onerous. They still have this sort of lingering problem of trying to get people into houses and home ownership. The truth is, not everyone should own a home.
Mm-hmm.
Owning a home is, it's part of the American dream, and it's a wonderful story. And if you can own a home, there are some benefits. But for some people, actually renting is a better financial choice, mm-hmm. because they need to put their investments not into their primary residence. They need to they're not saving enough money, and they need to save that money for their retirement. They need to put that into investments that will. That will pay them money. And your home is not an investment. I know that a lot of people have homes, and those homes have appreciated in value. But I love the definition. An investment is something that pays you money. but a home ownership that you've got a big mortgage on is something that you pay money for. And what do you get for it? Well, you get a place to live. Well, maybe you could have done that with your rent, and then you could have gone out and bought something else that's actually going to appreciate and pay you money at the same time.
Yeah, it's why I get so upset when I hear a local government elected official saying they're going to invest my money in one of their pet projects.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's go to the break. Final segment with David Morata straight ahead, 977-1070 is the phone number. We're revisiting 2008 and looking forward, market volatility. What can we expect on the other side? We'll talk about what lessons should have been learned and in your own situation, how you ought to react to what's going on presently. Stay with us. Come Saturday. All right, let's go to the final segment with David Morata. We do have an email come in from our friend Bill who says, here's a question for David. I'm puzzled as to why home prices have climbed back to the bubble prices of 2008. My understanding is the whole idea of the Case-Shiller Home Price Index is that Shiller found since the late 1800s, inflation and home size corrected home price has remained relatively constant. The housing bubble was just that, a bubble. Prices should revert to the norm in inflation-corrected terms. But the real estate and building industry constantly harps on the idea that prices should and will continue to rise. Sure, there's a shortage, but I think the main reason is psychological. Folks think that just because their home was worth a ton back during the bubble, it should go right back up. I would appreciate David's thoughts.
Yeah, and interesting. So the statistics suggest that bonds make 3% over inflation and stocks make 6.5% over inflation. The studies also suggest that commercial real estate makes about 5.7% over inflation, and residential real estate makes about 5.1% inflation. They're kind of a little bit between stocks and bonds. So if you just take the 5.1% over inflation, what that means is that the house goes up by inflation. Bill's correct. On average, that's what the price of the house goes up by. And then it's minus 1% because you need to do major work on the house. That's why it produces less than sometimes other stocks. Because if you wanted to take a budget for how what your major renovations and replacement of the roof and structural things, on average, it's about 1%. And then the rent should bring in maybe about 6.1%. And that's where you get the 5.1% growth is the rent. Mm-hmm. So he's correct. On average, house prices do not go up by more than inflation. Having said that, it depends on where the house is, and is the house in an area where more and more people are wanting to live. And so you could look at the growth of the population, and you could say, well, that's going to increase the demand, and that's going to push it up by a little bit more. So, for example, in my neighborhood, you know, the latest assessment values went up sharply because people like to be in the Meriwether Lewis School District, mm-hmm. and they want to be out in our area, and the, you know, the prices have shot up. This past year, the housing prices in Charlottesville and the housing market in Charlottesville was the tightest I've ever seen it in my entire time being here. We had three or four houses come for sale in our neighborhood, which is unusual. Usually there's none. And all three or four, I think three of them sold within the first weekend for $10,000 more than the asking price, and one sold without even going on the market. So it was very, very tight, very expensive, very hard to get into our neighborhood, and that demand has caused the housing prices to go up. But he's correct. On average, housing prices don't go up by more than inflation. A lot of the rest of it is supply and demand. I don't know that this is a great time to be buying a house. I have now come full circle. I've said during the housing bubble it wasn't a good time to be buying a house. Then after the crash, I've said it's a great time to be buying a house. This is the first year when I thought I would pity someone to be trying to buy a house in this market because I think they're paying too much. I don't know how many years that's going to go on, because things like that can go on for, you know, 5 years before anything changes, and they can go on for 5 years and continue to go up irrationally. That's what markets do. In fact, Alan Greenspan, his comment about the irrational exuberance of the dot-com 1990s actually happened in 1997, and we had three more years mm-hmm. of incredibly up markets, which had you gotten out when he made his comment, you would have missed out on a great bull market for three and a half years.
Let's go in our remaining couple of minutes to current valuations in the market. Are we in an overvalued market, quote unquote, or how should people look at their investments presently?
Yeah, one of the things that we do for our investments is we have a whole bunch of different categories, maybe 30 different categories, and we look at the forward PE ratios of each one. A PE ratio is price per earnings. So if something is stock is selling for $16 a share and it has $1 a share per earnings, it would have a price per earnings ratio of 16. And if it was, you know, you get a dollar in earnings every year for 16 years, and then you'd still own your share of stock. 16-ish is, you know, 14 to 16 is average for kind of different categories of markets, and that's sort of where things are. The forward PE ratio in the U.S. stock market is currently 15.94, so we think that the U.S. stock markets are fairly valued. Mm-hmm. Probably the worst valuations are in the real estate market right now. Mm-hmm. So U.S. real estate, also called REITs, real estate investment trusts, have one of the highest PE ratios we've ever seen. We've cut our real estate investments back to half, and I wonder why we have the half we have. So that's one of them. Technology is also a little bit overvalued, and that's what corrected the most in this latest correction. That's brought it back into line a little bit. The trailing PE ratio is about 20.18, but the forward PE ratio is this 15.94, which we think means that the earnings expectations are better than the trailing earnings. And that gives it a fairer valuation. Probably the best, one of the best priced categories that people might be normally invested in is emerging markets. The forward PE ratio for emerging markets right now is 10.64. It hasn't had as great a decade as the U.S. stock market, so we think it's more fairly valued. And I would not hesitate to put money into emerging markets, partly because it didn't do as well this last decade than the U.S. did. And that's another thing that people have to remember is a decade is not long enough to judge any investment. Mm-hmm. The last 10 years in the U.S. stock market have been fantastic, partly because 10 years ago it looked so bleak. The 10 years before that were really bleak, and anything other than the S&P 500 did better than the S&P 500. So if you invest based upon the last 10 years, you'd think the U.S. markets were great. If you invested based on the 10 years before that, you think the U.S. investments were terrible. And that's why we have a nicely, broadly diversified global portfolio, because you never know what is going to do next, do best in the next 10 years. And having a piece of everything means that you'll have a good share in the markets.
Really instructive program. I wish we had 2 hours on the topic because we really just scratched the surface. But you can get more information online at maradaonmoney.com. David Morata, thank you as always for a terrific hour.
Thank you so much for having me.